Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I want to talk about the story which I came this close to giving some airtime to last week. Producer Pete poured cold water on it, though. It was about what some people believed was happening at Oak Park River Forest High School in the curriculum. And I said, look at this, look at this. Because somebody I know and trust sent it to me and said, look at this, look at this. And so Pete looked at it and said, yeah, I'm not seeing that elsewhere. And I said, well, da-da-da-da-da. And Pete said, da-da-da-da-dee. And now there's a story today, da-da-da-da-do, and sounds like it's a bunch of da-da-da-da-do-do. And yet, one of the points is that once these things get going, they sort of, the snowball gets bigger as it goes downhill, and it's a snowball of credibility, even though it is an incredible and untrue story. We're just going to talk about that, tell you a little bit about the story and about that phenomenon, which still happens in the 1 o'clock hour. So Eric Zorn, you and I are going to pass on that topic today.
So we're not going to traffic in any fake news? Is that what you're saying?
You know, it does remind me of a book that I read and interviewed the author of, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And it is in that book instances where sometimes people get shamed for things for which they are not guilty, things that aren't true that have somehow stuck on them. Now they've been publicly shamed, and once that happens, it's impossible to take it back. And the point in this Oak Park River Forest High School story is that it's been on social media, and some of this misreporting has gone viral, and in some ways, you never get it back, Eric.
Well, that's really true, and I think the thing to focus on, I know you'll be talking about this coming up, is that you know this story sprung from the local government information services, which is a chain of propaganda outlets that look like local news sites. And those kinds of organizations, those kind of websites and disseminators have sprung up in the wake of the weakening of local media so that you have something that looks like a newspaper or a news site covering your community. And they do a pretty good job of concealing their true identity and agenda. And so when the story goes out, and this, I don't know how you responded when you first saw the story, but I had the same thought, which is like, this looks like a real news story in a real news publication. And I had to really check my first impulse. And you know, Pete did a good job, you know, grabbing you by the reins and saying, let's take a look at this. Yeah. And all of us have to do that, right? With all these news sites out there, that you need to be able to judge the credibility of what you're reading. And you know, I know you're going to get into this.
Well, it's one of the reasons I don't like Pete. It's because I'm like, oh, Pete, this is so good. And it has the patina of credibility or truth to it. But here's the thing, too, Eric. This is kind of the difficulty of this. It looked like a legitimate news organization that I wasn't familiar with, but there are so many small news organizations that, you know, Patch is a good local credible news organization. And maybe some folks aren't familiar with that. And this looked like a little tiny version of that. And here's the thing, too. I think it's bad that people are putting misinformation out there for their own purposes. But another layer of bad is when you build a sort of infrastructure to support your crap, you know? I mean, if you're going to load some crap, just throw it out there, fine, we'll all figure it out. But now you've built this little fake news site or news web, and even that thing isn't real, let alone the stuff that you're putting on it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it looks real, and I think that your antenna drooped down a little bit because it's not something you see on Twitter. I mean, anybody who's on Twitter or on Facebook knows that there's a lot of junk that gets spread around. But when you go into a site that calls itself, in this case, West Cook News, that looks like a newspaper. That looks like maybe another Pioneer Press or similar to the Oakleys. And you think, okay, well, they're first on this story, and they got it wrong, and they got people all worked up and all excited about something that wasn't true. And you're absolutely right that it's really, really hard to recall a story like that, especially when the people who are behind it don't come out and tell their their sources. I was looking online to see, you know, Andrew Sullivan, who's a fairly respected journalist and someone who I generally admire, retweeted that story, and I think he just took the tweet down. I went and looked at his Twitter feed, but he didn't correct it. He didn't, as far as I know, and I, you know, you can miss things on social media, but I went and looked to see if Sullivan, who I consider to be a fairly honest broker on things like this, he just like, oops, erased the tweet. And I don't think that's good enough when you're someone with that kind of an audience, because people see that, they do screenshots of it, they spread them around. It's really important when you see something that really, really vibrates with your own views and really confirms something you think is true and is outrageous. That's a real warning sign to make. Double check. Go on to Google. Go to Google News. See if other outlets are covering it, other reputable outlets. Sometimes you can still get fooled. Sometimes stories get out there that aren't true.
It's been shared 10,000 times on Facebook.
Yeah, and I feel sorry for the people in Oak Park and River Forest who have to deal with this, because I'm sure they're getting inundated with angry emails and texts and things like
that.
And
will in perpetuity. I mean, because now 10,000 shares beget 10,000 more shares, beget 100,000 more shares. So that thing just, it's forever in the water, and you cannot, you know, sift it out. And you just hope that, you know what you do then? You put your head down and you go back to doing what you do, knowing that that's just the culture you're going to work in, that's out there. I want to move on. It's 11:42. And there's a serious story and a silly one. Let's do the silly one first, take a break, and then come back with the serious one. The silly one is, you say, the Oscar Rogers Award to campaign politicians. What is that, Eric?
Well, Oscar Rogers was a character on Saturday Night Live back in the 2008. He was played by Kenan Thompson, and he was a political figure, and they brought him on to the Weekend Update, and they asked him for his solutions to problems. And do we have a sound clip of him?
But how do we go about fixing it specifically?
Take it one step at a time. Identify the problem. Fix it! Identify another problem. Fix it! Repeat as necessary until it's all fixed!
So that's Oscar. And so I wanted to, I noticed this in the Republican debate on Thursday night, that these politicians come out with these extremely vague pronouncements and that basically amount to, I'm going to fix it. And so I thought I would award an Oscar for the a debate performance. But can I read you the nominees first?
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay, because former State Rep Paul Schimpf, responding to the question, what's the one thing you will do to help us solve the issue of gun violence? The one thing, he said, we do have to take action on this. Leaders need to lead, but it's important that we listen first and figure out what solutions actually can help the situation. Leaders need to listen. And we have to do something about mental health. It's a huge issue. We also have to make our schools safer. But most importantly, we have to have a governor who's going to hold himself accountable and say enough is enough. That's your fix-it nominee there. Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin.
By the way, Schimpf is the guy the Tribune is endorsing, right?
Yes, and he was last in the polls. It was a long-shot endorsement by the Tribune. He's a serious politician. I think in another climate, in another race, he could have been the one who
got
all the money.
I thought he did credibly in the debate that I saw him in, but keep going.
I did. Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin on specific steps needed to enhance school safety. We have to look at this holistically. How do we stop crime generally in the state of Illinois? We've got to focus on making sure we support our men and women who wear that badge who keep us safe every day. Gary Rabine on teaching LGBTQ+ issues in schools. We've got to be a state that really cares about the growth of our kids. And parents, not politicians, need to be building the curriculum with our teachers. We've got a lot of work to do in Illinois. We've got to become a state where hopefully we can bring God and country back into our schools. And Jesse Sullivan was asked the first thing he'd do as governor. He said, when I'm governor, I'm going to crack down on crime here in the state. We've coddled criminals for far too long. Max Solomon, in his closing statement, said, our cultural and social values are under attack. Evil used to hide, ladies and gentlemen, not anymore. Evil is here. It's attacking our children. I will protect our kids, their security and safety in our schools. And the winner, the first winner of the Oscar, goes to State Senator Darren Bailey when he's talking about battling crime in Chicago. He said, Mayor Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker, Kim Fox, and their woke anti-police politics, they are responsible for this. If we're going to restore Chicago, somebody's got to tell the truth. I said it. And when I'm elected as governor, I'll fix the problem. And we will restore the greatness to Chicago.
I think he gets bonus points because he said fix it.
But how do we go about fixing it specifically?
Take it one step at a time. Identify the problem. Fix it. Identify another problem. Fix it. Repeat as necessary until it's all fixed.
Did I cut you off there, Eric?
No, you did not. That's exactly what I wanted to say. Fix it.
All right, it's 11:46. Here's the question that may be our news click today. There is audio and there is video images. There are, I guess, I don't know if it's video, but I know there are still images and there is audio of the Uvalde shooting. And the question is, should that be released to the public? Think about that for a minute. Eric Zorn publishes something called the Picayune Sentinel, a newsletter that drops on Thursdays. You remember him as the longtime columnist at the Chicago Tribune. You read him sometimes in the Daily Herald in the suburbs and throughout Chicagoland. And he's a member of the Mincing Rascals, the podcast that we do on WGN Radio on Wednesdays. You can always find the new episodes at WGNRadio.com. Eric regularly joins us along with Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute, Heather Sharon from WTTW, and some other folks around town. And our own John Hansen is part of that team. And one of the things that Eric is talking about today is he said he has thoughts about the release of the 9/11 recordings and gruesome photos from Uvalde. Should we hear the voices from inside the classroom? Should we see the images? And my answer is absolutely not. I've never liked it. If you call 911 and say, you know, my husband's been shot, or there's an intruder in our home and there's panic in your voice, that can be really scintillating audio. And that might make the local radio or TV news. I think it should never make the news unless you agree to have it used. Unless when you call 911, you are calling because you need help, not because you are de facto signing a release form. I know that the police is a public agency, and you can sometimes make the argument that we should all hear what's going on because maybe then we'll catch the bad guy, for instance. But that almost always is not the case, and it certainly wasn't the case in Uvalde. The only reason to justify the release of the video, the still images, or the audio of those children talking to 911 is so that it might move a handful of Republican senators off the dime, either shame them or force them or educate them as to the horror of these crimes so that they finally decide to do something marginal. You know, closing the loophole at gun shows, closing the internet loophole, red flag laws, will not make it more difficult, not much more difficult, for people to get guns. People who want guns or need guns will still be able to get guns. They say, well, this won't fix the problem. And I say, this won't create a problem for you. And you're not a wizard. You don't know if this is going to help or not. Maybe it will. In some states where they have initiated laws like these, it has helped. California is one of them. But let's give it a try. Remember, this does not subtract from gun ownership. It does not take your guns away. It's not going to make the thing worse. So why not give that a try? And obviously, that's not very persuasive to some people. Fair enough. But then maybe the release, you know, that argument, but maybe the release of the images or the audio would. That's the only way you go down that path. And right now, I'm of a mind to say, no, let's not do that. Eric, I got you on the phone now. What's your thought about that? Where are you on that story?
Well, I agree with you totally about the idea of voluntarily letting people release that audio. When you call 911, it is at probably one of the worst moments of your life. And you're not thinking about how it's going to sound on the radio or on a website or on a TV station. You're in fear. You're in panic. All the worst emotions, probably the worst time of your life. And that audio is often played, in my opinion, just for its entertainment value, for its diversionary value. It doesn't have any real value in terms of helping us understand the crime any better or understand what's going on. It's just to show you how awful people felt. And I've been thinking about this idea of that there is certainly audio of recordings from this, from the little girl in the classroom calling and talking about how her teacher is dead and she wants people to come and help. We know very well how slow that response was. We know how horrible it is that 19 children and two adults were murdered in those classrooms. We don't need to have audio to confirm that for us. And I think that that's if the parents of that girl want to say, yes, play that, we think that would be good, that would be up to them. If I were a news director, I don't think I would play it.
Well, I was thinking about that. So say they said, okay, now it's the ball's in your court. Do you play it? What do you think, though, Eric? I mean, are you at all interested in the notion that maybe that would shame or persuade some of these senators?
Well, there is something to the fact that these images can move us. The Emmett Till is certainly an example of that, and obviously the images of George Floyd being murdered made people galvanize the nation to see that. And I think if it had just been a news story that this guy had been choked to death by police outside a convenience store, we wouldn't have paid nearly as much attention. So this photographic evidence is galvanizing to people. It can also be very polarizing, and it can be dehumanizing, which is why I would definitely want to give the families first rights of refusal. But we have this tradition in the media of not showing those things, no matter who wants us to. You'd be hard pressed to find a media outlet that shows images even of the planes going into the World Trade Centers anymore. That we just feel like that's
an interesting point. They always freeze the video. We have plenty of video of cops shooting Chicago men, and they always freeze frame it right there before the we don't watch it.
But I thought that, for instance, the Laquan McDonald shooting, the one of the young man who was shot back in 2014 that resulted in all that all the publicity in the trial and so on, that watching the moments that he actually went down and watching how the officer continued to fire was very important to that case, to see what really had happened there. And so I thought that video, I thought it was maybe not journalistically responsible to stop showing that video before the first shot was
fired. And that one, the police were lying to us, though. The city, the police were lying.
Right. And, well, we don't even know what's going on in Uvalde exactly with that. But I think that the images of what the AR-style rifles do to young bodies, to anybody, but to these young bodies, that you saw the news reports, right, that they had to take DNA samples. Yeah. These kids were so badly mangled by those bullets. And to show these are the kinds of weapons that an 18-year-old can walk into a store and buy. And this is the kind of damage they can do. And this is something that we need to come to grips with. I think that that's perhaps something that is useful. The other thing, of course, is you could show the kind of damage that it does to a sack of flour or something, or gelatin or something. It gives you an idea of how powerful and destructive.
That's an interesting thought, because I see the value of it, but I agree with you that I think there must be other ways to demonstrate it. I'm out of time. Eric Zorin will talk with me and some of my friends a little bit more about this when we record the Mincing Rascals podcast this week. And I presume you're writing about it too, huh, Eric?
Yes, absolutely.
In the Picayune Sentinel. It's the newsletter that drops on Thursdays. We'll talk later, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Bye.